This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, buddies. It's Michael Cruz Kane, and this is another episode of A Good Cry, the comedy kind of podcast about grief, definitely. Thank you for listening, for sharing, subscribing, for rating, reviewing, blah, blah, blah. If you haven't done those things, do them now. Do it now. Or maybe do it at the end. I don't know. Or do it at the beginning. Do it all the time. Always be doing it. That's my famous saying, ABDI, always be doing it. Also, of course, thanks to people who are emailing and DMing me your questions, your comments, your concerns, your criticisms. You know what? I've got a couple criticisms, and let me tell you, I love them. Very bold to throw off a criticism on a podcast about grief, and I respect it. Grief thought for the day. How long are we supposed to be sad about some shit? I mean, at what point do you finally go, I'm done with this. I put it in a shoebox inside of my heart, and I never open that shoebox anymore. That is a question that I frequently wrestle with, and I think the answer is as long as it takes. And I think in parentheses next to that, we write, and it might take forever. Close parentheses. Your relationship to grief, if it's like mine, will evolve. It will grow. It will shrink, if that's the right word. It will turn a bunch of corners, and you have no idea where it will end up. So if you're struggling with, shouldn't you be over this by now? The answer I would give you with my zero expertise is you'll be over it when you're over it, which will probably be never. But you'll be able to manage it if you don't feel like you can manage it right now. For this episode, we have my good friend Josh Sharp. And this is one of those episodes that was recorded back in the beginning of the pandemic, like when COVID was at its absolute peak, he said, hoping that we are not about to reach another absolute peak. So you'll hear some references to early pandemic life, but I love this episode too much to bury it forever. So you are getting it right now. We talk about Josh's mom. We talk about her saga through doctors and her treatment for cancer, and also the way Josh thinks about the time between when he knew his mother was going to die and when she finally died, and his relationship to that part of his life and his mother's life is something I think about all the time. It really moves me, and I hope it helps you too. This is A Good Cry with Josh Sharp. I hope it helps.
Hello, Josh Sharp. How are you?
Hi, Michael. You know, I'm okay considering the circumstances. How are you?
I guess I'm, you know, considering the circumstances, Josh, I'm doing great.
Yeah.
But that's considering the circumstances.
Right.
Like I would rather be doing this podcast within an arm's reach of you. And instead I'm in a closet with just, well, I'm in my actual closet.
Right. I'm finding that, you know, this time of pandemic, it's giving me the space and the time to rededicate myself to a lot of things I didn't have time for, like forced celibacy and having no friends, you know, the things I just wasn't prioritizing.
Yeah. I remember talking to you like in the BQ time and the before quarantine, and you were always like, I would love to just winnow some of these friends.
Yeah.
And now you're getting to that, which is great for you.
Yeah. I would love to have no physical affection for 2 months. It was something I had always said to you, and I was just like, but I'm so busy, you know?
Yeah, but think about when somebody does finally touch your human body after this, mm-hmm. It will feel like a shockwave to the system.
I'll probably die, yeah. I probably will die. Hey, speaking of.
Hey, whoa, cool transition. Who's the host of this podcast? So, Josh, as you and I both know, we have talked in depth about grief. You have the one-man show that you've been directing. I've also seen you perform theatrical comedy pieces.
Yeah, we're both known for our one-man shows about death, sort of.
Yeah, we have both found the smallest, saddest niche in comedy, and we're really pounding it out. But for people who don't know your story, would you tell us about your mother?
Sure, yeah. I mean, like, the highlight reel of her passing, I guess, is that she got diagnosed with ovarian cancer when I was in probably high school, and then went into remission. And then like 3 or 4 years later, when I was in college, it recurred. And then she ultimately did pass away. She passed away when I was like 23, I guess, because it was right soon after I'd moved to New York. And my brothers were younger. So it's been like almost a decade now, honestly. That's sort of like what actually happened. I mean, like some of what, as you know,
that's like the log line.
I mean, some of what, which we can get into now or later, of like when I would talk about it in that show that Michael has referenced, was it's sort of about that, but really that's like the backdrop for how she like gently bullied me out of the closet, you know, in her last year of life.
Yeah. Like, I mean, you can sort of go through the show without referencing it specifically.
Yeah. Actually, if you would shut up for 55 minutes, I could just do the whole thing. No, I will. I especially now that it's now, as you see, Michael's sort of, you know, making me do material on his pod. So if you ever see me do this on a stage, it's not gauche, you know? I'll try to make it more conversational. Actually, I haven't done the show in so long that I don't know that I would remember how to do it anyway.
It'll feel fresh. It will feel fresh.
That's what I mean. It's going to feel fresh. The remarkable part about it was that in the second time when she had recurred, when the cancer had recurred, which with ovarian cancer sort of means you're deemed incurable, that it's like a cancer that like seemingly you sort of like go into remission and it doesn't come back, or it does. And it's like, okay, well, you're going to live with cancer until you pass away, basically.
Isn't that just like a wild thing in and of itself? The doctors are like, we did it once. We're not going to do it again. We already did it.
I know. Yeah. We already did it. What more is there to do? The same thing again? Ugh, boring.
Yeah. We got other people we're going to try new stuff on.
So in that period of time, you know, she was like doing the chemo thing, which my hot take is chemo sucks. You know, I'm a comedian who's not afraid to go there. So
brave.
Because it is like you're just spending you are trying to kill parts of your body. You know what I mean? Like you are like literally sort of like poisoning your body to get rid of parts of it while keeping the other parts, you know? So it is a process, as I'm sure anyone in your massive grief-based fan base knows, that like it's like it is a thing where it's like you're not really living. It's like you maybe like feel good for a week, and then you do a treatment and you have like 3 weeks of feeling awful, and you're like starting to get better, and then you have to do it again. And it certainly is something that gets like more and more invasive the longer you go along. And so there was just a moment where, as my father ended up recounting to me after, that like, well, what basically happened was at a certain point, you know, that you're adding like more and more procedures on, there was like a non-FDA approved liver cancer drug that was a double blind study because it was like still in trial phase. So it meant that neither my mom nor the doctor would know if she got the real thing or like a sugar pill, you know, but it was like sort of, why not? Like, what do we have to lose? Like, throw it in with everything else. Who cares? And so she had started on that in addition to all sorts of other things. And then like a few weeks in, at one point, her like cancer indicators of like the prevalence of cancer. I mean, I'm not a cancer doctor, but whatever. Let's just say the number of 100 is bad and 1 is good, you know? They just plummeted 1 week. And so then the doctors were able to deduce that my mother had been on the placebo, and through a clerical accident, they'd fucked up and they'd given her someone else's medicine, and it was the real medicine. And then furthermore, it was working, which like sounds miraculous, but because like in the medical industry, like giving someone else the wrong medicine is like, you know, sort of a major snafu and a legal liability. They then had to have this very surreal conversation with my dad where they sort of sat him down and were like, okay, listen, we were giving your mom fake medicine, and then we accidentally screwed up and we gave her real medicine, and it's working, so we're sorry, don't sue us. You know what I mean?
Yeah, we're sorry that we're possibly saving her.
I know.
Does that mean that somebody else was supposed to be getting the fake medicine, or were supposed to be getting the real medicine, and they got swapped out into placebo?
Wow, that is a great... it's funny, you know, when you're thinking of your own story, you really don't think of anyone else, do you? And that is like I've never considered that before. There really, maybe that was the case. I don't know for sure, but I guess presumably maybe that is what happened. You'd like to think that they caught it, that they like switched the meds and gave mom the good one. And then we're like, oh no, did you give it to Amy? And we're like, oh, whew, okay, well, we have to, you know, I don't know. Yeah, maybe there's someone else on a podcast who's talking about how like my mom was doing so great. And then 1 week.
Yeah, she's doing like the photo negative version of this story.
Yeah. So then like the more remarkable part really was that then after that accident, they were able to convince the pharmaceutical company to remove my mother from the blind and just like give her the medicine. So and you know, pharmaceuticals not always known for their je ne sais quoi big hearts. So
right.
This was like, okay, cool. We're chill now. But then it meant that there was like a full year where my mom was basically like back to good health, like stopped doing chemo, was like back doing it. And then this is like what I call on the show very much like her Dolly Mama phase, where she was like growing up, lovely Southern woman, caring mother, like supportive mother, graceful, the kind of woman who could go water skiing without getting her hair wet. You know what I mean? Grace. Mm-hmm. And so we were always like had a good relationship, but we weren't like super tight necessarily. I wasn't one of those where it was like, you know, those people who are like, my mom's my best friend. Like it just wasn't one of those. But then I felt like in this period, she sort of like transformed and was like very aggressively inquisitive and wanted to just like know and be known and like talk about God and sex and religion and politics and just like hash it all out. Because I think rightly she was like, it was very second lease on life, right? Of like, I don't know this. I did not expect this. And I don't know how long it will last, you know?
And it's also like, maybe like, I'm going to get all my mothering in for a whole lifetime. I'm doing it all. I'm going to do it all now.
I think that's true. We've talked about how like it felt very three-dimensional chess, where she was like setting a lot of things in motion. Like my dad and I have talked about it, and I think like she really wanted to like do the work such that she felt like when she left, like she had done her part, that we would be okay. You know, that it was like, And so there was weird things where it was like, so like for me, it was that she sort of decided to have me come to help me come out of the closet, but she like did things for all of us in different ways. And some of them were even things where like, I remember there was a thing that I ended up telling my dad like a year or so after mom passed, like, you know, near the end, mom was always saying that she hoped like blah, blah, blah for you. And dad was like, she never said that to me. And I was like, oh, and it was like, oh, mom like set a little time capsule. She's like, I'm going to give you this. And in 1 year you'll tell it to dad when he's ready. Do you know what I mean? Like it felt like she was like doing a lot of that, where I just assumed that was like a conversation she'd had with dad that she totally had not, because she was just like, you know what I mean? Like, so there's a lot of that.
She had like set up a Rube Goldberg machine for your whole family's emotional health.
Yes. So it is like the like really truncated version of my thing is that then she sort of was like, so I was going to see her a lot. I was like, had just moved to New York, but I would go down on weekends and stuff and like see her when I could. And she told me she wanted to go to Palm Springs for like some time, just the two of us, which is very like, if you doubted whether she like suspected I was gay, like doubt no more. and so then she sort of asked me about a friend of mine who had come out of the closet and had gone really poorly. Who was also from similar like Southern circumstances. And so then when I told her that story, because she was a friend of mine, because his parents were basically like, we don't want to believe this. We don't think it's true. Like, you know, like that whole thing. And so I told my mom this and she was like, and she already knew this story basically. She was like, remind me again what happened to your friend. And I would tell her and she'd be like, huh, you know, I just can't imagine doing that. You know, I can't imagine knowing something about my own son and not wanting to deal with it. You know, even the things you don't think I'm ready for, you just have to sort of let me know. And then we can talk about it, because I don't know how much time I'd have. And she would just like leave the room like that and just like let that linger. They were very like drive-by truth bombs. You know what I mean? Water skiing without getting your hair wet. You know what I mean? It was very graceful bullying. So she just did that like all weekend. And I ended up being like, all right, all right. And I came out to her.
Did you feel like, was that a thing for you that you were, was there like any anxiety or stress for you around, like, I don't know if confessing is the right word or whatever, that to your mom before she died? Was there urgency in that for you?
I can't quite remember. What I remember is that like I had told like a friend, and then I had moved to New York thinking I would like come out, and then I like hadn't. So I think I just had this sort of like the like sense that some people have of this internal sense of like, oh no, am I lying to people? Or oh no, am I, or just like building it up to some degree where it's like, it feels very, you know, it's very sitcom-y where you're just like making a problem worse and worse so that it feels, it's very Evan Hansen. It's like you're digging the hole deeper.
Yes, of course.
You know, where it feels like the longer you go on, the harder it is to like just do this thing. So I can't remember how much I had in my head, like I need to tell her before she passes away, as much as I was just like, it was this thing building inside of me of like, God, you got to do this thing already. And so I did feel like she very much like gave me the sort of like Band-Aid ripping kind of thing.
Right.
Because I do remember like coming out to her and then flying back to New York where I just moved and being like, I'm out to my conservative Christian Southern mother and not to New York City. Like that is wild.
Yeah, I got it backwards.
And so truly like reckless abandon came out like full like BCC email subject line gay body C subject. You know what I mean? Just like really did the thing.
And how, like, what do you remember that conversation with your mom at all?
Yes, she was just like super loving and supportive and was just did like all the things you're supposed to do, basically, of like, you know, we love you as you are and we'll love you no matter what and we support you. And they did do a little bit of like, there were times afterwards, it was clear they had to process it through their lens, you know, that it was like,
sure.
I think like in conversations we had after, it was clear like it took them a little bit of time just to get completely, not comfortable is the right word, but just to like, I think they have that response that certainly people, particularly from that kind of environment, do where they're sort of like worried for you, you know, where they are like, this is going to make your life harder,
right?
Which I get. It's like in some ways it's reasonable, especially if you come from that world. But then obviously with time you start to realize, especially personally, you're like, well, no, there's nothing to be worried about. I'd rather be this, you know, but I see how, in addition to that, it's also probably some sense of just like reacclimating your expectations. Like not that it matters, but I do think like, especially for people of a certain generation, it's like, oh, I just always pictured you getting married to a woman and now I have to like reimagine that thing. So she was like incredibly supportive in that thing and then continued to be supportive. But I do remember having some conversations after where we just had to like sort of like, she had to like figure it out. But she was also doing all this work on her own. Like she was just like, I found out later she had like gotten all these like, you know, Christian devotionals about like how to care for your, you know, like gay son and like, and had done a lot of the work that you expect a person to do.
That is so sweet.
I have actually one day when I was home, not that.
Where do you even go to get, the How to Have a Gay Son book?
Oh, honey, when I was growing up, we would always drive to Hickory and go to the Christian bookstore. That was always the thing we'd do. We go to the mall in Hickory and then I go to the Christian bookstore and I could pick out it like a cool contemporary Christian CD. So I bet it's at one of those, although maybe not now that I realize, because I don't know how liberal they skewed. Maybe it was something.
Yeah, I was going to say, that'd be a pretty controversial book to be carrying.
I know. Maybe it was something she had to sort of like specialty order somehow. But there certainly is like a whole sect of Christianity then and increasingly now that is just like espousing like the scriptural basis for why you should like, you know, love gay people, you know, as wild as that sounds.
Yeah.
So I did like, she was approaching it, like it wasn't like shaking her, the fundaments of what she believed and who she was. She was like through that lens, like figuring out how to make it work.
And do you think, like, timeline for you then, do you think if your mother hadn't been dying, it would have taken much longer for you to come out to her?
It's so hard to tell because it's like, it definitely would have taken harder, but it did feel like I was like, every day I was like, how are you going to do it? Like, you got to do this. So it was like,
right.
I don't know that it's as much about time as much as that. That probably was almost the thing I was looking for. It was just like I remember in college before that, when I was even more closeted, thinking like, sort of having this idea of like, oh, well, when I meet someone, I'll come out, which is crazy because it's like, well, when you're not out, you can't meet people. You know what I mean? It's like such a catch 22 to be like, well, I'll have a boyfriend and then I'll come out. It's like, well, what? How? How? You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I guess there's also that thing where you said it, like maybe what was going on with your mom was the thing you were looking for. You and I have talked about this before, but like that confrontation with death really like turns the volume up on certain things all the way and on others all the way down.
Totally. I think that's completely true. And then like, and this is the, I mean, we've talked about this a lot in the context of our creative work and also our friendship, but it is like, it is why ultimately I sort of like look back on that time without the like, sort of what feels like the prescribed sense of sadness you're supposed to have, you know, like obviously parts of it are sad. Obviously that's like no duh, but also like I have a lot of gratitude for that time. And I have a lot of like, I have a lot of warmth for that time, which is sort of like what should be listed as like, you know, the chapter in your biography that's like, and then the hard year happened, you know, it's like, but I still sort of like, I feel a lot of warmth for it now. One, because I have that personal gift of just like her doing this for me. But in a broader sense, it's not even about that anymore. Because I agree with you. I'm like, at some point I would have come out even if she hadn't. Like it might, and it might not have been that much later, but it certainly would have been some degree later. But I also like, there's other elements of that time where I just, weirdly, this is the connection to now. Because I was talking about this with someone recently. That time, less so when she was on this sort of like miracle cure year, but more when that faded and she went into hospice and she was like ready to let herself go, which happened like a year after maybe I came out or less or so, when she did ultimately like pass away, which was about as seamless as that process can get, because I think she had so like reckoned with all of this stuff that like when she decided she was ready to let go, she was ready to let go, you know? That period, I remember just like leaving New York and leaving my work and leaving my life and going down there and just being with my family and feeling like it was one of the few times in my life, especially for us who are like weird comedian hustlers who always have like 19 gigs at once, you know what I mean? That one of the few times in my life that I was like, oh, I only have one thing to focus on. Like you sort of like, you get to like cancel everything and you get to just sort of like, just be like, I'm just here to be with my family and like experience this time, which was very like tough and intense in the moment. But then looking back, I sort of like have a lot of like warmth and fondness for it.
It is like those moments where you like are able to go notifications off for like the whole world.
Yes.
Creates a reverence for those moments, even if it's not like the moment you would choose. You know what I mean? Like
totally. It's like, it just like takes, it's so easy. Like if you're only confined to your own like brain to just like be reassessing all these priorities and stuff. So it takes like a huge externality thing to be like, nope, actually clear your plate, where it's like, oh, weird. Okay. Yeah. Cause you'd never make yourself do that really.
Exactly. The universe has decided to occupy the entire calendar for a second.
Right. So I do like weirdly have like a lot of warmth about that thing, which is, I'd say that just cause that's something like we've talked a lot about, like just the way the grieving process works and the things that you're sort of like supposed to feel.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's what makes, I'm sure other people feel the way you feel, but it's unique in my conversations about this, the way that you talk about that time.
Oh, I'm also a psychopath with no feelings. Sorry, I should have made that.
Yes, you're a sociopath. I think that's...
Yeah, I'm a full sociopath. I've never felt a feeling. I perform them sometimes to get what I want from other people, but...
Like a talented Mr. Ripley style.
Yes, yes. What a cinematic hero.
Is that a movie? Have you seen this movie?
I think I read it when I was in high school.
Oh, don't with I read it. Fine, whatever.
But isn't he gay? Isn't he like a gay villain?
He's a gay villain. I mean, it's hard to tell him if he's gay or if he's sort of like...
Oh, yeah.
His sexuality accords with what it is that he wants from life.
Right. Which, to be clear, that's what I came out to my mother as. I said, I'm gay, but purely for my own benefit. And she said, I understand that.
Mom, my sexuality is Machiavellian.
I said, trust, I'm going to make a career out of it. It will be fledgling and middling compared to a lot of my peers, but I will make one. And she said, I'd like to see that.
Do you remember, you talked about her being in hospice care. Were you there? How long was she in hospice? Do you remember?
Yes. So, because this is another crazy part that I rarely tell on stage. I think I did add it to that show one time when my dad was there. But like, what was crazy was it also felt like reflective of this thing where like sort of when I look back and I'm like, you know, if you're going to have this thing happen to you, if you're going to pass away from cancer, this period was like, that's sort of like the best it could go in some ways, you know? So like, obviously this like miracle cure moment, but then like after like, I think it was like a year, it started to fade, which we knew this liver cancer drug was not something that she went into it knowing it wasn't going to be forever. And the doctor was like, you know, let's just ride this till it doesn't. So it started to like not work again. And so it was the decision of like, do you want to go back into chemo? And she was like, no, I want to go into hospice. And so she was in hospice and like three or four, again, hospice, which I'm sure most of your audience knows is like end of life care. Like that's the point.
Yeah. It's like the waiting room to after life.
The waiting room to die, right?
Yeah.
So like a few days in, she was just having a bunch of like physical discomfort. She was like mostly bedridden, but at home. And so they gave her some weird like steroid to help with it. And weirdly, it also just gave her a bunch of energy. So she fully was not consuming food. They'd like put a port into her stomach so they could do the like liquid food thing. Mm-hmm. But then was in hospice for fully, I think, 4 months and was like, could drive her van. Like dad would take her downtown, like with her, like her boy Friday, like with her little bag port. And she would like drive and like go to the consignment store and like sell some of her clothes and stuff. So she like weirdly that gave her energy to live.
Dude, that's wild. So she would go to the consignment store and be selling clothes
to give away.
And like really, if the clerk had ever asked her, she would have been like, oh, well, I'm actually dying. So.
Oh, and dad tells me that was a thing that she was like, was very important to her because she was like a woman who like was like fashionable and liked clothes and stuff. And so in those last periods, she was like very into the idea that like, oh, I can't wait to like give joy to other women in this way. So it was something where like that hospice period lasted like, I think, 3 months. And for a lot of it, again, she was not, it wasn't like the miracle cure period where she was like back to 100. I think she would still like, she'd maybe be able to like drive the van downtown and do that and come home and then would be wiped, you know, but it was like, she wasn't like bedridden. And then in the last like couple weeks it started. So in that period I was in New York, but I was coming down like every weekend or every other weekend, just like, cause again, we were sort of like, we didn't know how long this was going to last. So it was a thing where I remember.
Right. Cause once it lasts for a month, then you're like, oh, well this could go on. We don't know how long it's going to go on.
Yeah. Then I'm like, I guess. Yeah. And then the crazy coda after that, Michael, if you really want to know all of it, is that like, then I was home the weekend 3 or so months in that she decided for sure she wanted to pass away. Cause the last like week or two, she was starting to like not be with it at all and having to give her more like pain meds to just sort of like, but she was like just kind of out of it. And so she had told my dad she wanted to basically like take off the feeding tube and like, I'm done, you know? And she, and again, she wasn't totally with it. So she had like told my dad, and dad remembers being like, she said that, but you know, sometimes she was like a little bit foggy. And so I was like, you know, I don't know. I'm going to revisit this with her later. And then like an hour later, he came back in and she was like, you heard what I said, Will, right? Like she was like fully like, no, I meant it. And so he's like, okay. So then I happened to be, it was one of the weekends I was home. And so we got to have this conversation as a family about it, where it was like, your mom is ready to go, so we're going to do this thing. And that like, it's sort of like the hospice literature says sort of to like tell her you love her and sort of give her permission to go, to like tell her, because a big part of your psyche just like wants to hold on even if your body doesn't need to hold on anymore.
You're talking about her psyche.
Yes, exactly. That you are supposed to like sort of tell the one who is soon to pass, like I'm going to be okay without you, because they're like, even when they're not totally there, there is some part of you that like needs to be released, you know? So I got to have like a last moment with my mom where I just like told her I loved her and gave her a hug and, you know.
I mean, that's, first of all, that's beautiful to me, but I do wonder what the science isn't exactly the word I want is behind like you. I feel like it's natural to say goodbye to someone and to say, you know, I release you or whatever version of that there is. Like, we don't, like, you know, you're free to go, like, go on ahead or whatever.
Yeah.
But I do wonder what the, like, from a strictly rational point of view, like, who cares? You know what I mean?
Well, but I have to imagine, and let's get into the neurochemistry of it, because I can think of two better people. But I have to imagine, because it is funny how much, like, in what little I do know about it, it feels like the brain is one of these things that are still, like, essentially a mystery to science.
Sure.
They're like, it's like the brain in the bottom of the ocean that we know like less than about than outer space. It's like,
yeah, even, I mean, chemotherapy is like that too, where like 100 years from now, they'll have a much better way to deal with it. But we're just like, right now we're just dropping bombs every place and we'll see if that helps.
It does feel like very like leeches, you know, it like feels like a thing where it's like, clearly there's a better way to do this, right?
Yeah. How do we get rid of the eczema? Well, we lit the skin on fire and eventually the eczema was gone.
Yeah. It's like, oh yeah. Oh, that is true.
Sorry. We're back into neuroscience.
But what I have to imagine is, because the brain is such like this incredibly powerful, complex thing that is sort of like running the body, that I bet like we just can't understand how like fully enmeshed it is into like all of your physical processes in a way that like, even if your body's like, I'm ready to die, your brain is probably like, nope, I'm going to figure out how to like keep working you, you know, like,
yeah, there's some like, for lack of a better word, soul in there that's like, well, I'm going to keep operating the toes a little bit for a while just to see what's going on.
But even in a non like, you know, like spiritual feeling way, it's like, that is stuff that happens to us all the time, where it is just like your brain can just like override certain responses. If you are like scared or nervous or whatever, your brain can just be like, oh, I'm going to dump a bunch of, you know, like serotonin in you right now for whatever. Like, it just like does things like that.
Sure.
So I bet there is some sort of like chemical explanation for how that works. And so you probably do have to like release the brain from doing its job, which is so weird, because then it gets to be ineffable feeling, because it's just like, how is this just like full, you know, fleshy electric thing enmeshed into whatever our like sense of self and drive and desire is? Like,
it's like giving a gold watch to your brain and being like, you're, you know, you're, you can retire.
And then here's the last little crazy thing about it. So like, I got to tell her goodbye, which was incredible. But then I remember like going back, and my dad and me being like, should I come back again? And dad was sort of like, I think you should leave, just sort of saying like, I'm not going to come back until the funeral. Because what we were also told was like, even once, like say you have sort of released her, the dying process for that type of procedure, especially where you're basically like sort of like deciding to starve, you know, is like, they're like, it can be really weird and messy because like the body doesn't just like that. It's like you, it sometimes takes days or a week or two even. And like, and I remember talking to my dad about that. He was just worried because my one brother was still like in high school. He was like 16 and he was like, and mom really wanted to die at home. But he was like, you know, they talk about how like the death rattle is a real thing, that you have this sort of like haunting new cough that like is really fucking spooky. And he was like, I just worry about this happening in the house where Taylor's going to have to keep living for 2 years. And like, we were beating all that stuff out. And then I got back and then truly like the next day or maybe the morning after, but it was like within 24 or 36 hours, she had passed away. And dad even went in one morning and was like, I think Amy's not with us. And then called the hospice nurse to be like, I think she passed away, and said the hospice nurse gave clearly a polite response that was basically like the nicest version of like, well, that's not possible, dumbass. Was like basically like, I'll come and check it out, but like that doesn't happen on day one. Right. And then came and she had died. But she had just like clearly had like, so even in that little coda, it was like, wow, even that part went about as well as it could. That like when she said I'm done, it did just happen in about 24 hours.
And do you think at all, when we talk about like telling her that she could go, do you think that that had anything to do with that?
I'm sure, but I also think all of what we talked about did, where I'm just like imagining like this world in which you had beat cancer once and then were given a year of life you didn't expect and felt like you had done all of this stuff, like we said, like felt like you had done the mothering you needed to do, and then even went into hospice. And it was like, I just have to imagine it that probably the psyche was easier to tell to quiet down, because the psyche was probably like, I mean, who knows? But I have to imagine that me telling her like, you can go now, I have to imagine she was probably like, yeah, I know.
like, yeah, it's actually not going to be up to you, ass.
Yeah, I've done the work. Have you not been watching me this last year? Like, I've been prepping for this, you know, like.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine like a desk just piled high with papers and her brain just like going through each paper and getting to the bottom one and being like, okay, well.
Yeah.
All the homework's done.
It is like the satisfaction of crossing off a checklist, you know? She got the inbox to zero.
Exactly.
To use an analogy that the kids will really like.
Which is, you know, something that I would find truly impossible.
Yeah, oh God.
Like, literally. Did you feel overcome with any of this at all at any time?
Yes, but I also get that, remember having that sense of like, and I wonder how much this was true for you, I have to imagine, that like, you have that thing where when your body's like responding to trauma, there's like a version of not quite shock, but just like overdrive, where you just sort of like, you just like power through it and it catches up with you after. So I remember in that time, not always like totally feeling like, because it was like right when I'd started like teaching in New York and getting a master's at night, and I was still like doing UCB classes, and I was also going down to North Carolina every weekend, where I was just like, what the, how did I just, you know, like.
So at a certain point you talk about everything being canceled, but then also when it like starts to uncancel itself a little bit and you're like unaware of how long it's going to take, you're taking on you're keeping yourself pretty busy.
Yeah. I can't remember exactly like how quickly I reintroduced that stuff to my life.
Right.
But I mostly just remember the period of just like juggling so much that feels like it was one of those like trauma overdrives, which I do think is good. And I mean, it's just like, not that everyone has to do that, but I do think some of your response is like, no, I don't want a lot of space in this moment. I want to be busy. Like I want to feel like I'm still like doing my life. And I also remember talking about that because my one brother lived at home. My other was in college and decided to take a semester off to be home. I remember talking to my dad feeling a little bad. Like, should I do that too? And him being like, no, I think your mom does not want that. Like she wants you to like come as much as you can, but you need to like live your life. Like she would feel bad, I think, if you were like, I'm going to pause my life.
And do you think that keeping yourself busy in that time was a thing that, because I could see that being a thing where it's like, oh, this is sort of forcing me, maybe in a way that I would want to put off the scariest feelings in here. Or do you think it was like, not that? What a very articulate question.
I don't know. I bet it has to be some degree of that, but I don't know if it's putting off the like scary feelings as much as it is like probably a natural response from your body to be like, oh, you know what's a more efficient way to do this? To sort of like, rather than just feeling like some of the hard thing all the time, to try and like say like, no, you might crash a little, but I'm going to like keep you feeling better for a while. Like that does feel like there's like a weird like, I don't know how much we're in control of that, I guess, is some of my thought. Like and also it's now like a decade and no, so I can't vividly remember some of it, but
hard
like
to remember. Yeah.
I am now like just thinking on it cognitively, and it doesn't feel like it's fully irrational to do it that way. You know where it is?
Yeah, no, I'm definitely not saying that. I think also, like, I'm trying to think of, for me, I think what I did during the time, like right around when my son died, was I focused my energy on like trying to make sure my wife was okay. I think that was my way of like displacing my own sadness, but being like, let's make sure she's not sad. And it took a while, or like levels of supreme anxiety for me to let the other part of me come out that was like, oh, you're actually also sad about this thing. You know what I mean?
I think I had some degree of that, but more my energy was focused on just like being like 23 and trying to keep my life afloat, you know?
Yeah.
But probably a very similar sort of thing.
Was it something that you brought back to New York with you? Like, is it something you talked with people about, or was it like a thing that existed in another world?
Yes. Luckily, I had, at that time, I still lived in New York with like two dear college friends who had moved with me.
So they knew your mom?
Yeah, exactly. So I had like new friends who were aware of some of this, obviously, but like could lean, like had a network of people. And our college crew was like very close, even the ones who didn't live in New York. So I just remember being able to like a lot of them came in for my mom's funeral from like all over places.
Yeah.
So I remember like that being more the thing that I did like have that outlet, but it wasn't necessarily like exactly my new New York network. Cause that's something I was still like forming it. It was still in that phase where I like sort of had work friends and sort of had casual UCB friends, but like hadn't built my network totally, because I was only like maybe a year-ish in, like a little over a year into being in New York.
So it might have felt like uncomfortable for you to be like, hey, I'm Josh. My mom just died.
Totally. Although I do have a memory of, because when I started to teach, I weirdly got this job that was in like Forest Hills. I was teaching special ed at Forest Hills, Queens, which is like a full suburban part of Queens. Like, it's
beautiful. I love Forest Hills.
But it's like Trader Joe's with a parking lot and a Wendy's with a drive-thru. Like, it doesn't feel like you're in New York anymore. And and I found the job through a friend but why it made sense for me is because the school was literally on Metropolitan Avenue, which we live on, but like 5 miles down the road, like the part of Metro that gets there. So there was no train I could take, but I could take the bus there. And so I like ended up getting this job in a part of New York that would have felt inaccessible to me if I lived anywhere else, because I was like, oh, weirdly, the Q54 goes right there. It's just like 45 minutes, you know?
Right.
So I got this job out there, and there was always like three or four of us who were like young New York City teaching corps teachers, but then the rest of them were just like old school folks who had been there forever. And a lot of them had come from this other school out on the Rockaways, which is a whole different culture of like these people who've lived out in like far Rockaway Queens forever. And it does feel like sort of suburban. And so they were aware of what was going on, and were, because they were like older and just like that kind of like suburban community network, they were able to be very supportive. Like, I remember this guy who was like one of the like sort of guidance counselors there, who was this lovely man named John, who just like would, anytime I had anything, like when I was going home to see my mom, he would always like talk to the principal and like be able to like leave a little early to like drive me to the airport, you know?
That's amazing.
And I remember like when my mom passed, the principal coming in, and like they'd already like figured out the teacher to take over for me that whole week. And John was like left during the school day to like drive me to my house so I could pack a bag in Williamsburg and then go to the airport. You know, like they were like good at that sort of like the thing that sometimes we miss in New York of like, that you get in a small town almost, that's like that little sense of community. They were very good at that.
Yeah, someone who's like, even though I'm not your like close friend, I'm keeping track of you. Like, I see you all the time.
Yeah, they were just like, this is what we do. Like, this is the 233Q family. Like, they were that kind of people, because they were like people who've been in the same job with mostly the same people, and also people who are sort of lifers who aren't like us, who are like, oh, everybody's here working this job, but everybody's got being pulled in 1,000 different directions because we're all like, you know, young and maybe aspiring to do other things outside of this. It was just like, no, this is what I do, you know?
Right. They've like settled into their life.
So I remember having a sense of that from these people who were not even like close friends. They were really just like coworkers, but they were like able to give, they were like very, they picked up the slack well. But I think they would have done that. I think that was a part of the community that was like, that they were good at that thing. That if someone was having a hard time, it's like, we fill in, you know?
Yeah. That's right.
But I do have memories of that I'm like, that I probably don't value as much as I should, as far as that being like a good support network. Like, I'm glad I was there at that time and not, you know, I don't know, working at a restaurant or something where you might have felt like gotten what felt like a colder or more calloused response.
Yeah, you're like a cog in a machine, and they're like, yeah, we'll get your shifts covered and then do whatever you want.
Yeah, both that and also just working with a bunch of other 23-year-old dirtbags who would probably like send you a text like, yo, bro, sorry your mom died. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. Can you work my brunch?
And having people who are like, no, I have a car and I'm 30 years older than you, and I'm going to like sort of like father you in this moment and like, you know, take the day off and get you packed up and get you to the airport and, you know, whatever.
And if they're 30 years older, there's also a very solid chance that they've had a parent die also. Like they're like, I know the hole you're in right now and I can help you out.
They are. Yes. I think they're probably like, I'm making you a casserole, people. You know what I mean? Like,
yes, exactly. That I'm going to drop off and not say a single word to you.
Yeah. Like
I know you don't need that.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Oh, here's another crazy part that I glossed over from the story, Michael, is that like, that weekend I was home and my mom decided she was like ready to go. We had this conversation as a family about that thing of like, we have to let mom go and blah, 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 blah. And what, unbeknownst to us, my father had forgotten amongst all the chaos of, you know, having your wife choose to pass away, that like people from the church, because this was in December, had basically like reached out to him like earlier in the week and been like, hey, just want to let you know, is it okay if on Saturday we come by, we're going to do something for Amy? And they were basically like, you don't have to do anything. We won't even like knock on the door. We just want to do something for her. And he's like, yeah, sure. Like not even thinking about it. So he had not even warned us this was going to happen. And then we were at the dinner table, like having this conversation. And then someone noticed and they were like, look outside. And what they had done is there was this one tree in front of my mother's window that was dead because it was winter. And so like 60, 70 people from the church had all like made like big red heart ornaments and had hung them all on this tree. So it was like truly like lit ablaze, like with all of these like red ornaments, like it was like fully fall. And they were just like standing in the driveway, just sort of like there. And it was just like we just hope when Amy looks out her window and knows the community is here with her. And it was one of those like, you have no clue what's going on inside this house. Like to do that, the synchronicity of that happening on the day that she had like told us she was gonna pass away and we were processing this intense thing as a family and then being like that is like movie shit where it's like, go look outside and there's like the small town is all there and it's like, oh God, I guess this is why you live in a small town. You know, like, so then here's another crazy thing is I recently, like last fall, went down because my brother's been doing this ovarian cancer benefit in my hometown for this charity he started to take care of like women who worked in the same place that my mom got her treatments in.
Yeah.
And it takes care of a lot of the stuff that healthcare doesn't cover. It's a really cool charity because it's just like, sure, you maybe have healthcare that's helping with this stuff, but there's like one center in Western North Carolina and these women are having to like drive multiple hours to get there and then need a place to stay. So this is like, they give you money for like a hotel and for freaking gas. And they also do these like, my brother's a big fly fisher, so they own this retreat center and they take the women out there and teach them how to fly fish. It's like a beautiful thing.
I love this. Also, just like total side note, also hot brothers. The brothers are very, very attractive brothers.
Michael, you dirty little creep. Thank you.
It's just true.
My hot family thanks you.
Okay. Also, dad.
Also, oh yeah, dad's a cutie.
Also, dad, scrumptious.
Dad's a dang cutie. So like he always does this benefit, and for a while he would do a big concert and my other brother's band would play, which makes a lot of sense because they're like sort of bluegrass Americana music, like that works, and they would do it at this big theater. But they had changed the event last year because they didn't want to do it at the theater anymore and they wanted to do something that was a little bit smaller. And so Jacob Taylor had been like, do you want to come down and do comedy for it? And that's like the last thing I want to do in my like conservative, I was just, like, it's very much like when they're asking about like, you know, my brother's career is, it could be like, they can be totally involved. And when they're asking about mine, it's like, it's going well, you know, don't watch any of it. You know, it's like that kind of vibes, you know?
Yeah.
But I did go down, and why Taylor did it, which was smart, is he was like, I just wonder if you could tell a version of the story about mom at this thing. And so I basically like wrote like 5 minutes of like jokes that would play to that room and then told this story, but included that part because I was, and it was true. I was like, this is to me like one of the clearest signs of like why I think a community like this is valuable. Like this is like
the part about the hearts in the tree.
Yeah. I was like, right. That is like a vivid memory to me, especially me as like a coastal elitist who like looks down on those places often, that it's like, that is the thing that is like, you can have, you uniquely have in a place like that because of the choices everyone's made to like lead a certain type of life and make certain types of priorities, you know, that I think, again, we don't always do in our lives, but,
a memory that jars in me that is, I would say, at least sad is the word, but it's also like in an absurd way funny, is that we had a tree. My wife and I had a tree planted for Fisher. We live right alongside a park, and we had a tree planted in the park for him. Like we had
in the one I know,
yeah,
the
yeah,
one over
in Williamsburg, and we had to go through the parks department, and the woman we spoke to was like super nice and gave us, she was like, there are all these kinds of trees. Here's the tree that I think would be the best. Like it would do the best in that park and whatever. We went, we had some people over and we planted the tree, and the tree was doing well. Within like 6 weeks, the kids in the park had beaten the shit out of the tree so bad that also the tree died.
Oh no.
I mean, how just so awful.
Well, you know, we planted like a cherry blossom tree for my mom at our family's like lake home.
Yeah.
And there's all sorts of stuff where it's like, you know, spooky shit happens where someone will be like talking about her and like the wind will blow leaves from it on them and they'll be like, hi.
Sure.
So my point is, if you want to give Fisher a tree, I don't know, maybe you could put it on my family's property next to my mom's tree.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll come down there. We'll put it there.
At least a bunch of kids won't beat it up. But
do you feel like,
wait, I have to know, is the tree like dead and gone? Like the city came and removed it?
It's gone. They literally took it out of the ground. Like there were branches under the tree the kids had broken off. They were, I don't know what they would hit it with, but like the bark of the tree.
So you talked to the city about this and you paid for it? Like you had to like.
Yeah, we paid for the tree to be installed in this park.
And then the city called you like, hey, dude, sorry, we had to cut down your tree.
Well, no, we would see it like every day. We would never see people like vandalizing it or like, you know, being rough with it. But every day you'd go out and someone had done another fucked up thing to the tree. And you're like, come on, guys.
This is another like, why do we live here? Just like, what are we doing?
The literal opposite of your community is East Williamsburg, New York.
Yeah.
Like most of this, what you've talked about at the time, right around when your mom died, do you feel like whatever level of grief you've had, like, does it carry forward? Has it changed since then? Like,
yes, but like a lot of the, well, I've definitely found myself like, cause I don't, like I said, I don't feel sad about her or it a lot because I think I have so much gratitude for it. And also I sort of am like, even in the ways that don't feel as explicitly positive, I'm still thankful for the ways in which it made me, that I do think I have a certain degree of just like, I don't know, nihilism or existentialism or just this feeling that it's like we're not really due the day we're born, which is like, again, not like the Hallmark lesson, but I'm still like thankful that I have some of that.
Do you think that comes from, do you think you had that, or that when that happened with your mom, you're like, I think of life differently now?
I think it's mostly the latter. I mean, I don't think anything's like can be fully a creation of just that moment, you know, like,
sure.
But I do think it was like, certainly like was a big thing that like pushed me into some of the person I became, I think, for reasons that didn't just have to do with like coming out of the closet, that I'm like, oh, there's even more ways in which it sort of shaped my outlooks. But what I was gonna say is that like recently I found myself like missing her more than I had in a while. I think in no small part because I'm like quarantined alone and recognizing the ways in which I'm like, oh, this would be the time that my mom would send me a care package.
Yeah.
You know, like missing some of the like being cared for has made me like be thinking of her more than I normally do, I think.
Is that something she would do, or have you conjured a new mom?
100%.
Okay.
No. That was like her thing. Like she was like sending me to college with like way too many giant Tupperwares of like, you know, nonsense.
Yeah.
And also was like a woman who like made holidays really special. You'd like wake up and she'd do a production. You know, like she liked to like...
Oh, I love that. That's a great... There are many genres of mom that are really great. That's one of the great ones.
That's what I mean, where I'm like, even in the growing up, like she was a very fun and like caring mother. I just didn't know, I didn't necessarily feel like tight. Like there were lots of stuff we didn't talk about, but it wasn't like all of my growing up mother-son relationship was like positive. It was just that that sort of like miracle cure moment was like this exciting new thing I didn't expect to happen, particularly with a woman who was like, oh, you're my, you know, proper, polite, Southern, caring mother. You're not the person who I like call to like get into the nitty gritty about, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, she definitely was that. She would certainly be sending me care packages. I'd be like getting Girl Scout cookies in the mail or something. She was that person.
That thing that you talk about too, about her making like the holiday special, is something that, now that you mention it, I feel like I give such short shrift to those people in my life. Like, my wife is also someone who's like, it's Easter, like, let's do something for Easter. And like, my initial reaction to that is like, but why?
Yeah.
But there is that, like, ritual moments, including like funerals, birthdays, all that stuff, that like press pause on the universe to be like, this is a, we're going to create a special memory right now. There's something that's just so powerful and awesome about that.
I do. And I know we're just like nihilistic assholes about it. And that's why it is.
Yeah.
And I do think there's like something right to like thinking critically about these things and like trying to not just like celebrate consumerism. You know, like,
sure,
obviously we're like two full socialist commie Bernie bros talking about it. So I'm like,
right.
I get that. Like, I still want, if I had kids, I would want to be like conscious about not just that, but the idea of just like making a thing special, and the idea that that sort of mentality doesn't have to just apply to the Easters, you know, like,
sure,
like birthdays are the ones where it's like, oh, you can do this without really feeling like there's any sort of just like, you know, neoliberal proto-capitalist nightmare I'm supporting. But I mean, like, even outside of holiday stuff, it does feel like there's ways in which you can keep that mentality to just like making those things feel special. Like, but Easter is one where I do remember waking up and there would be like a trail of jelly beans, like from our bed, that would like full like family circus, you know, where you'd see the trail and it like go over everywhere.
Yeah.
They were like leading to you to where your basket was hidden, and we each had a color, and you'd be like following them, and they'd go like up over the couch and then under a table, and then it'd end up like having taken this hugely circuitous route to get to wherever they were hidden. But like things like that, where we would wake up and be like fucking crazy for this stuff.
Yeah, my kids are like that too. My kid, I'm like really, I have never thought to give credit to my wife for that really until like now. But it is true. Like, that's the thing. That's part of like family to them are those rituals.
And just like that sense of like, for lack of a better word, like production. It was just like, I get why as a kid you were like so excited, because it was like, there felt like there was mystery to it. It was like a thrill to like have, like, not just like wake up and sit down and her be like, here's your basket. Like, to like have to like follow the, it's like,
there's a show.
There's a fucking show there. There's like, that's a story, you know?
Yeah.
So I do think there's something to be said to that. Anyway, this affirms most of what we said, which is that Carrie's the real deal. That's sort of that's always my point.
Yeah, exactly. My wife, Carrie, is the deal.
What does she do? Because I'm also curious of what the like New York City version of it is, just because there's like less space and whatnot.
Oh, we do like an egg hunt in our, like, basically entirely in our living room. So there's just like, they wake up, they have the baskets, but the baskets aren't full of the stuff yet. And then they have to go around the house finding the eggs. And then
right.
She makes, like, you know, like Easter dinner is like there's an effort. Most of the time I cook like pretty much anything that gets cooked in the house, but Easter is like, that's Carrie's holiday pretty much.
And what about birthdays? Are y'all big on birthdays?
Yeah, we're big on birthdays. What do we do?
Those are the opposite of death. So this is still thematically related.
Yes, those in fact are the opposite of death. We used to do, we have done huge birthdays in the past, some like too big. We did one where the biggest one we did was for my son. We did a thing at like this local play space that cost like $1 trillion. And it culminated in them having a hand truck that was decorated like a Spider-Man character. And they would put him on the hand truck. And then there were sparklers that like spun around, like shooting off sparks all around him.
Oh my God.
And they just roll him out and everybody's clapping like mad. And my son is in just abject terror as fire blazes around his face. And we were like, we're not doing this again.
Well, but that is production.
Yeah. That's, in many ways, the opposite of a funeral. Although
I can't believe your Broadway loving son didn't want to be wheeled around on a handcart as Spider-Man while sparks fly. That's basically the whole plot to Turn Off the Dark.
Yeah, now that I say it, I wouldn't mind if someone did that at my funeral. If my coffin came out and you just had the sparks flying around on the sparklers, something to think about.
I do have a lot of friends who have done you know, like the sort of like, here's the plan for what I want my funeral to be like. And I haven't done that, maybe because I don't, even though I'm totally of the mindset of like, it could happen any day. I'm like, but it probably won't happen this year. But I probably should. But you know what's frustrating about those things is there's no way to make them legally binding. And so ultimately you're just making a document that will get disregarded.
Yeah, exactly.
Like how many times have we heard that people are like, my funeral should be like this. And then once everybody's there and you're not, they're like, well, but no, we're going to do the normal thing.
Right. He's actually dead. So it's not up to him.
So I think that's why I haven't done it. Cause in part I'm like, it does feel like a farce. And I wonder how you would actually make sure your wishes actually happened.
You'd probably have to have like an estate.
You're right.
A sizable estate where you could hold over people if it doesn't get executed.
Again, neoliberal proto-capitalist nightmare. You'd have to pay for it.
Yeah, that's
right.
What
you'd have to do. You'd have to have already paid for it. So that people are like, because then the people will be like, no, it should be this. They'd be like, it's literally already paid for. It's happening or not. You could just like pay for it again on your own. And people are like, well, I guess no. I mean, it's
Josh, that's our startup. We do. You're going to, we like people who are about to die. We make sure their funeral goes off how they want it to.
Yeah. We're the outside party because then your friends and family, when they like sober up, they're like, well, we can't do all this crazy stuff. But then we are the ones who are like, hey, we got no skin in the game. They paid us. We're putting googly eyes on the coffin like they said they wanted.
That's right. Get us the Shark Tank.
Which is, to give credit, that's one of Nicole Byers' things. Do you know that?
She wants googly eyes?
She wants giant googly eyes on the coffin.
That's very funny. That would be very funny.
It is funny. And I do get it that a lot of our, you know, fuck up friends are like, I want a funny funeral. But it is true that it's like, it would be so fun to have a funny funeral.
It would be.
Actually, this is an example of it. I guess it speaks to like, if you have the right people around you, they'll do it. The Timmy Wood UCB thing was pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. You were there for that?
Yeah.
I assume?
I wasn't there. I was out of town, I think.
Oh, well, it was awesome. I mean, your people might not know, but there was this guy, Timmy, who I wasn't even super close with, but I knew from UCB, who passed away really young. I think he was like 30 and it was super suddenly, just had like a heart thing and died instantly. And so they basically did like a big show at UCB to celebrate him. And people fully did bits. Like it was like, some of it was very sweet and poignant, but some of it was just like classic UCB midnight. Like, oh no, you can't be doing this bit. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But about a person's death too. In a way where it really did feel like, oh yeah, Timmy would love this.
Yeah. And I think that's the stuff where if it does, even though I wasn't there, like the legend of it is how apropos it felt to that guy and like how much he would have loved that. Like,
because in addition to being a UCB dude, it was just like specific, I think, to what I understand to be his sensibility of like, oh no, he would have loved these bits in particular.
Yeah, just like a good dude who was always seemingly like upbeat and down for anything.
Yeah, down to clown.
I wanted to ask you, are there ways in which you feel like to get back to your mom that do you reckon with that more? Does it feel like a thing that's still like complicated for you, or does it feel kind of like settled?
I guess it feels mostly settled, but like most things, it just feels like I always feel like every like, you know, I don't know, 5 years or whatever, I just sort of become a new person. And it's not like it's happened all at once. It's just like it's like death by a thousand cuts or whatever. It's just like a bunch of little things have happened that have gotten me there. So that's what I mean. Like, I don't know that it exactly like right after my mom passed, it like pushed me into this place. But certainly as the years went on, it was like that.
Yeah.
And so I do think it's like always sort of ebbs and flows, but it is a part of things, but can shift too, where it's like, even though it feels very settled now, I do imagine that in 5 years, if we revisited this, I would be like drawing slightly different lessons from it.
Right.
So it is interesting how that process is like both in flux and yet feels settled, because it's like all these minute things sort of, you know, like make change over time.
Yeah. I think also I would just imagine as you get closer to whenever it is you assume you will die, you start to have a different perspective.
Right. And as I think I get closer to like different milestones for her, I'm sure like if and when I have children, I would be thinking of her in a different way, because there'd be aspects of like her as a mother that I'd be more conscious of, you know?
Yeah.
So this is me saying it does feel very settled, and yet I fully think it's like slowly changing all the time.
I got you. That makes sense. That paradox checks out. Were there any things that happened while your mother was dying, or even afterwards, while your family was grieving, that were like either were absurd to you or that were funny or like really inappropriate?
I wish I had better memories of those, because I don't really, and I'm sure they must have existed, because I love, I mean, I don't know if you've told the story of the receipt on your podcast yet.
Well, if I had, I honestly don't remember, but the...
You should, because it's a perfect example of what you're talking about.
That whole story is pretty brief, but it's just taking my son to get cremated at a funeral home. I mean, they sent him out someplace. And then them handing me a receipt that at the bottom of it said, thank you, come again, which is just like a truly an insane thing to have at your kid's funeral, to have someone say that to you is absurd.
You couldn't put together a writer's room that would make a joke better than that. You know what I mean? Like that is...
It's incredible.
That's what I did like about that Chris Kelly movie, Other People, is I feel like he was good at highlighting like that moment. You've seen it?
Yeah, I love that movie.
That moment when the movie opens and they're all sitting around with her in the moment she dies and the phone rings and they're all trying to ignore it. And then it goes to voicemail and it's someone just trying to talk to the mom like, hey, wanted to check in. How you doing? Haven't talked to you in a while. You know, whatever.
Yeah. Here's the movie. Igby Goes Down.
No.
I think the mom dies in that movie too. Spoiler. And I'm butchering this memory, but it's something like the kids going through her social calendar and just calling everybody in it and being like, hey, just so you know, my mom can't come. She's dead. Hang up. Call the next person.
Well, there's also that iconic Roseanne scene where Laurie Metcalf is calling the hard of hearing man to tell him that you've seen it, right? Or it's just like
so good.
So I feel like there are things, and that's clearly like an exaggerated sitcom version of it. But I don't have a lot of specific memories of that, which is not to say they didn't exist. I just think I either did a bad job of flagging them and remembering them.
I could also see you being like kind enough of heart to absorb all those things as not absurd and to be like, I understand what this absurd thing is doing for you. And therefore, I don't perceive it as absurd.
And I also do generally remember like feeling like each of my family was on our own journeys. Like, I think I maybe like processed some things quicker than other aspects of my family. And I'm not saying that's like healthy or good necessarily. I'm just saying that makes a lot of sense given the circumstances, because it was like, well, the three of you were all there like living with her for a month. So I think you are bound to have a different type of grief than I do. And also I did get that very specific, like huge gift of like, you know, like the version in which this doesn't happen means she didn't help me come out of the closet. You know, like there's like,
yeah.
So I do think I like processed things in a different way than the rest of them. So,
and also your brother's nonprofit is obviously, I feel like, related.
Oh yeah.
To your mother's passing. Like there are ways in which your mom's death put her into the world just like differently. You know what I mean? I don't know.
Yeah.
Like the idea of energy or whatever feels maybe not super true to me, but maybe it is true. I don't know.
I think that's definitely true. And I think that is part of that like sort of three-dimensional chess thing. But also that's why I wouldn't be surprised if some of those moments happened, I might not have like focused on them at the time, because I think that would have been something that like would have spoken to my brain, but not as much to my family's at that moment. And I could see that I might have been a little bit like, we don't need jokes right now or something.
Yeah.
I just don't have a lot of memories of that.
And you talked about that sense of not being due any number of days. Like that's a thing you sort of learned from your mom for your mother's death. Are there other things like big takeaways that you have from either that time or like the way in which you think about it now?
There is that sense of just like trying to be, and I think that one's easier to do because it's just sort of like a thing that you have to just like put in your DNA almost. The next one I'm going to describe requires more action, but that idea of like being conscious of how you like affect people and just like thinking of the ways in which you can, not that you, I mean, this feels like such basic ass advice because it's like, live every day like it's your last. And I don't mean exactly that, but I do think of like she specifically in that sort of like, whoa, I was given extra time I didn't think about. I think like put a lot of effort into the ways in which she tried to like care for us and give things to us. So I think that's like something I think about a lot, but don't always feel like I'm doing. I'm just like thinking about that thing.
Like she got a second chance sort of that she didn't expect, and you may not get that second chance.
Right.
You may be like, someone might press stop on your life
right
at any moment.
Which is so hard because at the same time, it's like by virtue of being given that second chance, it is like that sort of like, how often does the universe say cancel all your plans? Like it's like,
right.
It's not like it's easier to do once that happens, but it does naturally feel like, of course, you like pursue those things in a different way, that like, how can we fully recreate that feeling when you're not in it? I don't know. But it is something I think on at least, or I like try to do in ways that I feel like I can. Or if not, I just like, I definitely flag that in my brain. So I hope that it like permeates some of my actions, even if I'm not like explicitly always being like, be like your mother. You know, like I do think,
yeah,
I do think that was like a big takeaway.
I mean, I have that same thing of like, you know, my son died, and there's definitely like moments where I'm thinking to myself, like, do like live this day for your son. And then there's also days where I lay on the floor and play FIFA on the Nintendo Switch all day. And it's like, I don't know how I honored anybody today. I'm not sure if I made it.
I guess something about that, that like, I think is important for us to remember in our career, because so much of like what success looks like is about scale. You know, it's about like, we are like ultimately trying to like perform things and find audience and impact lots of people. And there is a thing to remembering like the utility and like having individual impact that like that is like has just as much merit as some of the things that we're pursuing. So trying to balance both of those, I think, is like an important reminder.
Yeah. I mean, that's definitely, having kids makes that inescapable. The like,
oh yeah, that's true.
You know, that I'll be like, whatever, working on a script or something, and my son will come in and be like, hey dad. And I'll be like, hang on one second. And then like Cats in the Cradle is playing in my head. And I'm like, what am I doing? Like,
the
script is for him. Like, what? Who cares? Go talk, go hang out with him.
Yeah.
But I'm confronted with that feeling a lot of like my, you know, being with my daughter.
We have humans that you have to make sure don't kill themselves.
Yes, exactly. And also there's that element of like having had a son who died, there really is like, you know, it's way deep in the background, but the music of one of these could die too. Everybody you know, like your version of it seems a little more upbeat than mine, but really like my thing is like, oh, these are all going to be dead. I don't know who's going to be first. I mean, probably me, but anybody, it could be anybody.
Yeah. But again, that makes sense to me in the same way that I'm talking about, I would process this different than my family. It's like yours is a version of like processing death with a person you were able to get nothing from ultimately, sort of in some ways.
Yeah.
It, like at that moment, you know, and learning how to get stuff from this person who you had so little time with, where mine is easier to imagine like, oh, I got so much from this person before they did pass. And yes, it sucks that she like died at 49, crazy. But I'm like, wow, I managed to get a lot out of those 49, and specifically out of those last two. I'm like, it's wild, you know, that like, to me, it's like, I think I said this to you last time, maybe we talked. It's like, I don't even feel like I've made the choice to be, I don't know, Pollyanna about it. I'm like, I truly am like, if you just look at the facts, I think that's just like what it is. Like, it's just like, it's hard not to just say like, well, this is a better way that thing can go than most, you know, for lack of better words.
Yeah.
That like, I'm not surprised. It feels very rational to have this response to me, but I guess that's the point of living in your own brain, is everything feels rational.
Like, yeah, right. It's rational to me.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you one more question, which is, where do you think your mom is now? Like, is there some conception of that at all?
I don't know, because
like, you talked about the tree, right? About like, you know, people will be by the tree and the wind will blow and all this shit.
It's funny because I like both like don't really, I feel very agnostic about it, where I'm not like fully like, I'm not fully a, what's his name? Like Richard Dawkins. I'm not a Ricky Gervais out here being like, she's nowhere. Like mad that anyone else would think that.
She's dead, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't feel that as much. I don't personally like have any sort of like concrete thought of like where a person goes when they die. But yet the idea, so it's like, I don't really believe that she's necessarily in this tree. And yet the idea that like, oh my God, look at the way in which I am still telling her story, and my brother's still telling her story, and my other brother's still telling her story. It's like, well, then she's very much still alive. Like that is like an easy way to understand the sort of like, where do people go? It's like you sort of do live on in other people in a way that like, that's a different, I mean, and that's not that far removed from just being like, she's in the tree, you know? So it does feel like there is a certain like weird cosmic spiritual aspect to that.
Yeah. I think there's like dissipation includes the idea of like weakening. So I don't really mean that, but do you understand what I'm saying? There's like
yes. It's a permeation, maybe.
A permeation, if you will.
But the dissipate is good to see how it's like spores that it's like going out. But again, that's, I guess, a part of that like does feel buoyant, because it's like, that is a thing you can affect. Like you, I can, like, if I'm trying to like sort of have this impact in other people, like I can live on, like, that's the, and again, which you don't want to be living your life with this like weight of like, you don't want to be doing it for that reason. You don't want to be doing it so that you can.
Yeah. Sure.
You want to be doing it so that you can have, like, once you're doing it for the right reason, it does give you the other thing too, I almost imagine. But that's what I mean. Like, it does feel like why having that guiding principle of maybe trying to like think of the ways in which you affect people ultimately will be positive, because that is what allows you to have this sort of like, I don't know, she, how do you live on sort of thing we're talking about. I guess.
Yeah.
That was a really, you know, meandering way to answer your question. But
well, that's also, you have that exact paragraph tattooed across your chest.
Yeah. I was just reading it off my own, and I do it upside down so I can.
It's upside down, yeah.
It's very memento where I have it so I can read it in the mirror, you know?
So we like to end every episode with the plug for the movie Memento.
Check it out, guys. Check it out.
Which has paid for advertising time on this podcast.
Yeah. They want us to read that you can definitely stream it somewhere for some amount of money. And that's just the plug.
We don't have ads here yet, but one day we will have them. And I just can't wait to find out where I'm going to be reading the ads.
When you're renting Memento on your Apple TV, please put in the promo code GOODGRIEF to have it for the same amount of money.
Yeah, for zero discount.
Yeah, what kind of ads do you think are a natural fit for this podcast?
Oof, I mean, I really don't know. I want some kind of witch doctor shit. That's what I want.
Yeah.
I want to have ads for like shamans and stuff.
Yeah.
No disrespect to shamans. I want to get a shaman on here. I want to talk about that. I got friends who've done the shaman stuff, and I want it.
Only respect to my shamans.
Only respect to my shamans, which make
a... Put respect on the name shamans.
Josh, I think we did it. That was Josh Sharp. I'm Michael Cruz-Kane. Thanks for listening, and I love you.
A Good Cry is produced by Radio Point and HeadGum with executive producers Alex Bach, Sabrina Fonfetter, Richard Corson, Daniel Powell, and Houston Snyder. Recorded, edited, and mixed by Bree Mattan.
That was a HeadGum podcast.